All right, today is Monday, March 7th, 2022, and this is the Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee. For the record, we do have a quorum. We have three bills on the agenda today. Since the first two bills are similar in nature, we'll have Senators Gazelka and Limmer co-present their bills. And that way we can comment on the similarities and differences between the two versions. We'll then open this up to committee discussion. So to begin with, Senator Gazelka, would you please start with Senate File 2576?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I've got Senate File 2576, mandatory minimum sentences for violent crimes committed with a dangerous weapon. So not just gun, but other things as well. And I'm going to present, and then, Mr. Chair, I need to step out, but Senator Limmer's on my bill as well. So Minnesota Statute 609.11 lays out the current mandatory minimum time an offender spends in prison for the most violent offenses committed with guns or other dangerous weapons like knives, crowbars, baseball bats, etc. Subdivision 4, if a person commits one of the listed violent offenses using or brandishing a dangerous weapon, a first offense has a mandatory minimum of a year and a day. A subsequent offense has a mandatory minimum of 3 years. Subdivision 5, if a person commits one of the listed violent offenses using or brandishing a firearm, a first offense has a mandatory minimum of 3 years. A subsequent offense has a mandatory minimum of 5 years. Subdivision 9 provides the list of violent offenses. So here they are: murder, manslaughter, assault, kidnapping, robbery, burglary, arson, criminal sexual conduct, escape from custody, and drive-by shootings, etc. However, Subdivision 8 then allows a prosecutor or judge to waive that mandatory minimum for first-time offenses. They're supposed to impose the mandatory minimum for repeat offenders. So this is what this bill does, Mr. Chair. It removes the prosecutor and judicial discretion to waive that so-called soft mandatory minimum and instead requires prison time for these violent offenders. Although judges are most often in control of sentencing, prosecutors are also allowed to waive the mandatory minimum prison time, which is something I alluded to last week with the carjacking bill. Prosecutors do play a role in sentencing, and their opinions count. Again, these offenders are convicted of one of these violent crimes, and either they or an accomplice used a dangerous weapon when they committed it. Despite having a mandatory minimum sentence available to prosecutors and judges, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission reported in 2020 that between 2013 and 2018, judges and prosecutors refused to sentence the mandatory minimum in felony firearm cases 40% of the time across the state. 40%, Mr. Chair. For data, 2019 data, the most recent non-pandemic data we have, we turn to the fiscal note beginning on page 12, and we look at the cases indicated that mitigated dispositional departure rate, commonly known as downward departure, for cases, for the 940 cases that were sentenced by prosecutors, 40% of them did that. Of the 558 remaining cases that received commitment to prison, over 10%, 59 cases received a sentence that was shorter than the mandatory minimum. This should be alarming to all of Minnesota, as violent crime in almost every category has risen steeply in the last 2 years. Every year, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension puts out the Uniform Crime Report, which is the arrest and criminal activity gathered from law enforcement across the state. And the data is alarming. I've seen some of the preliminary data from 2021, and here's the difference. In 2019, there were 117 murders. In 2021, instead of 117, it's 197. In 2019, there were 3,081 robberies. 2021, they jumped up to 3,898. In 2019, there were 6,742 aggravated assaults, That number from 6,700 jumped to 10,692 in 2021. The violent crime problem is not going to get better if there are not sufficient consequences for a person's action. So, Mr. Chair, that's why I brought about this bill. I can tell you that as I was thinking about this, I was actually talking to a pastor in Minneapolis from the minority community, and he's the one that said, why, if somebody has already been convicted with a gun and they're a felon and now they have another conviction with a gun, why aren't they automatically going to jail? And so that was the beginning of this, and I've asked research to help put together this bill, which I'm very, very grateful about. But because prosecutors and judges are not using the tool that we gave them to consistently take violent crime seriously, the legislature will have to intervene and give them explicit guidance about how serious we are in taking the most violent criminals off the street. Last thing I'll say is I said last week when I was before your committee, Mr. Chair, that we're in the top five for least amount of prison sentence, as high as 49th, depending on who's measuring it. And I think we need to move that needle the other direction a little bit and send a message that if you're willing to do these kinds of heinous crimes, you're going to jail. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. I know Senator Limmer has a bill very similar to mine, which I also support, and I'll trust the judgment of the committee to find out what's the best path forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have two questions. What is the intent of these being laid over for inclusion, or are we voting them out to finance?
Yeah, thank you. I should have said that right at the beginning. So these are going to be laid over, Senator Bigham.
Cool. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My other question is, I don't see the County Attorneys Association in here, but they were invoked numerous times during the testimony about how they conduct business. I was just wondering, this is like the second week now that we've done these prosecutor bills, and I'm not saying that these are wrong at all, as a matter of fact, but I'm just saying, like, wouldn't we have them testifying on some of these bills that are kind of dealing with how they conduct their business?
Yes, and you're aware, and I think most on the committee are, that this agenda was posted several days in advance, and the opportunity for public comment was there, and they chose not to comment on it. So, but it's still open. So if they were in the audience here too, they could comment, but I don't see anybody, so.
Mr. Chair, Chair Limmer, if you would yield for a question on behalf of you and Senator Gazelka. Were they asked to, was the County Attorneys Association asked to testify on these bills?
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator Bigham, I was told that these agendas were posted, that anyone could make comment. I have not had conversation with the Minnesota Attorneys Association, so I don't know if they didn't have time to show up. I just don't know, and I have not heard anything from them.
Okay, and Mr. Senator Chair, Bigham. just one other comment I would say on it. I mean, the fiscal notes are vast, and they have, you know, public defenders, courts, corrections, and stuff like that. So I hope as we're putting this bill together that those organizations will be asked by this committee and leadership to testify on these bills, because they're the ones that have to clean up our mess that we pass, and we don't want to create one for them. And so I think they should be at the table talking about this. Maybe they're just holding off until later on in the session, but I would hope we're proactive about asking them to come, because I certainly would be very interested in hearing whether or not they think this is helpful or not, because I think they're a key part of keeping our community safe.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that Senator Gazelka's bill and Senator Limmer's bill are actually in response to the mess that is out there when criminals are not getting the consequences that they should be brought to by county attorneys. So I would say, I look at this as saying, this is our response to saying, on behalf of the people who are having carjackings, all kinds of crimes, children being harmed, because repeat offenders are not, who are violent, are not being kept out of the public and then become a very real risk to families and children. And so this is our response at saying we want them held accountable for their actions and their behaviors because they are a danger to society, which is the whole purpose by which we do this kind of work. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, in response to that?
Senator Begum?
I don't necessarily disagree with you, Senator Kiffmeyer, but I don't know that every county attorney conducts their motions in the same way. There are office policies that each of the county attorneys have where they are not allowed to offer plea or go down on a downward departure agreement in an agreement with the defense attorney. I know there are county attorneys that do that. So I think that's where a lot of the discussion needs to happen, because I do think there are offices that already don't do what Senator Gazelka and Senator Limmer's bills are putting into state statute. So in other words, it's already in practice in some offices, I believe.
Thank you. I think at this point we'll proceed with the second bill. Senator Limmer, if you'd like to present on yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to direct the committee's attention to Senate File 2673. It, in many ways, it's similar to Senator Gazelka's. However, we do not go quite as expansive on the use of a weapon definition. We stay focused on firearm. And I think before I get into the description of the bill itself, I think it's important to unpack a little bit of the background that our public is experiencing, especially in the metropolitan area. Going back to the 2020 report from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, they recognize that the fastest growing crime in Minnesota between 2010 and 2018 was possession of a firearm by a convicted felon who committed a crime of violence and is therefore already ineligible to have that firearm. The rate doubled between 2010 and 2018. This is highly significant, and we know that a significant amount of crime is being committed by persons who are not allowed to have a firearm. And might I suggest that it's possible some of these more recent crimes might not have happened if someone who committed a first violent crime with a firearm between 2010 and 2018 had been in prison instead of committing subsequent offenses over the past 3 years. Again, I would like to note, between 2013 and 2019, a prosecutor or a judge decided 40% of the time to not incarcerate someone who was convicted of a violent crime when a firearm was involved. You know, we had a hearing not too long ago, another year, I think it was last year, when we brought that out. And when I go around and talk to people in the in my local community, as well as having a hearing. I was about to say I'm the luckiest person. No, I won't go there. But I wanted to say 2013 to 2019, a prosecutor or a judge decided 40% of the time not to incarcerate someone who was convicted of a violent crime when using a firearm. That's rather significant. And when I say that in front of people groups out in my district, as well as having a hearing here, there is a collective gasp in the room when the public hears that 40% of the time that individual who is found guilty does not get prison time. There are four reasons that we have incarceration for those who commit serious crimes. One is a consequence of punishment. Serving time as a way for a convicted person to pay for the harm inflicted on another innocent citizen. The other one is an incapacitation. We remove that person physically from society, a convicted person, to prevent them from committing future crimes. The other element is deterrence, the prevention of future crime, both an example to others and the idea that they have committed crimes will be discouraged from committing further crimes. And then, of course, the other reason to incarcerate someone is hopefully to rehabilitate that person, get them back on the straight and narrow, get them to be a useful person in our society. And oftentimes, it's a combination of those four elements. As a background, in Minnesota, we have one of the lowest incarceration rates in the country. I think we're the second or third lowest in the country. We rely on a different brand of probation than other states. First, it's cheaper, and quite often we realize that a lot of people in other states that are in prison probably could do better if they had treatment or counseling to correct their behavior. And they're not considered the worst of the worst, as has been defined in our commentaries in recent years. We put those individuals in prison because they're a threat to public, or there are those who are chronic offenders who continue to break the law. If this list of violent crimes when committed with a firearm is not the worst of the worst, then what is? Our citizens are aware that Minnesotans are facing an increase in violent crime across our state, and unfortunately, much of that violence includes criminality involving a firearm. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension's 2020 Uniform Crime Report states that Minnesota recorded a over 16% increase in violent crime just in 2020. And most notably, there were 185 murders in 2020 in Minneapolis compared to 117 in 2019, an increase of over 58% murders in Minneapolis alone. 75% of Minnesota murders in 2020 were committed with a firearm. Let me repeat that. 75% of Minnesota murders in 2020 were committed with a firearm, up from 69% in 2019, just 1 year earlier. In 2021, we will know a fuller picture when the BCA releases its complete and final uniform crime report in a few months. But so far, what we've heard, the numbers do not look good. As Senator Gazelka mentioned, the preliminary data the BCA had gathered from law enforcement as of 2 months ago is that 197 murders happened in Minnesota in 2021, and the headlines do not seem to indicate a miraculous decrease in 2022. If you want to focus on race and equity, according to the BCA's preliminary data, 120 of the state's 197 murder victims in 2021 were African American. Nearly half of the state's 2021 homicides occurred in Minneapolis. In 2019, there were 1,225 robberies in Minneapolis in 2020, and there were 1,783 in 2021, and that number jumped to 2,111. In 2019, there were 1,677 aggravated assaults in Minneapolis. In 2020, there were 2,270. And in 2021, there were 2,984. We definitely have a rise in violent crime. The public is aware of it. Wherever I go, people are talking about how they feel unsafe anywhere in the metropolitan area. And you know, it's rather alarming that when I hear that, and in the background, I still hear that between 2013 and 2019, a prosecutor or a judge decided only 40% of the time not to incarcerate someone who's convicted of a violent crime and used a firearm. This means that both robbery and aggravated assault nearly doubled in the last 2 years in the city of Minneapolis. These are not victimless crimes. St. Paul reported a record number of homicides for 2021. Aggravated assaults jumped from 946 in 2019 to 1,605 in 2021. I suppose we can be grateful that it appears robbery is actually down a little bit in St. Paul after jumping 25% from 2019 to 2020, as the 2021 number of 512 robberies is close to the 2019 number again. Minneapolis and St. Paul, as we've read in headlines, have had an astronomical increase in shootings committed within their city limits, and that is spreading fearfully into the suburbs. I want to emphasize, we need to send a serious message that criminal use of firearms will not be tolerated in the state. And I'm afraid we have to give a little bit of a comment to our judges as well. Legislatures in the past had mentioned mandatory minimums, and they're being ignored by our judiciary. If we would live by the law that the legislature creates and the governor of some time past has signed into, if you're going to commit that crime, you're going to go to prison for using a firearm to commit a crime. I can't say that today. That would be for crimes like committing carjacking, perhaps drug deals going wrong, innocent children being murdered by drive-by shootings, violently stealing someone's grandmother's purse in front of a store, a violent domestic abuse situation, or rival gangs deciding to settle disputes even during the time of someone's funeral. Senate File 2673 requires a hard mandatory minimum sentence for violent crimes committed with a firearm. From the fiscal note, Sentence Guidelines Commission used 2019 data. That was the last available pre-pandemic figure. The mitigated dispositional departure rate for the 722 cases that were sentenced in 2019 was 38.5%. 278 cases where the offender was not sent to prison. Of the 444 remaining cases that received commitments to prison, 13.1% received, that's 58 cases, received a sentence that was shorter than the mandatory minimum duration. There is a bed count to this bill. The initial bed impact of firearm cases is 139 prison beds estimated in 2023, and the number will grow from there until reaching full capacity. Or there will be a deterrent factor, and criminals will begin to realize that if they use a firearm in the commission of their business, victimizing someone else, that they're going to go to prison. Mr. Chair, we'll stand for discussion.
Thank you, thank you very much, Senator Limmer. I think with that, Mr. Backus, are you on? I see you're there. Could you pop on for a second and just lay out, for my benefit, the difference between these two bills quickly from the more technical standpoint?
Mr. Chair, members, it's kind of a question of breadth. The Senator Gazelka's bill, as he mentioned, is broader than Senator Limmer's bill. Senator Limmer's bill eliminates the right to sentence without regard to the mandatory minimum only for firearm offenses, where Senator Gazelka's applies both to the firearm offenses and the dangerous weapon offenses.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Appreciate it. Questions from members? Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This might be a question for Mr. Backus. Do both of these bills, what's the definition of dangerous weapon beyond a firearm that's in Senate File 2673?
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and members, it's the definition that's applicable to the criminal code. It's in Section 609.02, Subdivision 6. So it would mean any firearm, whether loaded or unloaded, or any device designed as a weapon and capable of producing death or great bodily harm. But then it goes on to say any combustible or flammable liquids, or instrument or other. This is probably the, you know, maybe in terms of how broad it is, it also includes other devices or instrumentalities that in the manner it is used or intended to be used is calculated or likely to produce death or great bodily harm. So, you know, Senator Gazelka mentioned some of them, but in some respects, it also depends on how the item is employed as well.
Senator Latz.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Backus, would that include a stick if used, or an umbrella if used in a manner that could create substantial or great bodily harm or death?
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know. We'd have to parse the language out. I'm not sure if there's case law on anything specific like that, but again, it would have to be something that in the manner it is used or intended to be used is calculated to produce death or great bodily harm.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, that sounds like it could apply to any object if it's used in a way that's intended to cause great bodily harm or death. So a bowling ball, an umbrella, statute book. You know, if you whack someone hard enough over the head with a statute book, you run the risk of them falling down, and maybe you intend to make them fall down and hit their head on the ground or something. I don't know, but it sounds like that could fit. Mr. Backus, does it have to be a separate object? I heard of a case once where a person who was skilled in karate used his foot to attack someone else. The claim there was that the foot constituted a dangerous weapon. Would that fall, do you think, within this definition, or would it be excluded from this definition?
Mr. Chair, members, I've not tried to look into the case law involving this. I think it would turn on whether or not that would be considered another device or instrumentality that in a manner used or intended to be used is calculated to produce death or great bodily harm.
Senator Latz.
I see Senator Gazelka made his presentation and left the committee hearing room. Is he intending to come back, do you know, to answer questions about his bill, or is that left to Senator Limmer?
Senator Latz, he did have another appointment that was before this. I got late on my start, which pushed him back, so I apologize for that and his inability to stay because of that. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's not your fault that you got a late start. Senator Nelson had a rather lengthy bill with rather lengthy presentations by Senator Nelson on the floor, and I think that delayed, and others, I will say, it delayed our start here, too. So, Senator Limmer, I think you're the one in the hot seat here on behalf of Senator Gazelka. Although I must say, I think we've seen Senator Gazelka more this session than we saw him in his entire Senate career up until this year, and must be something going on outside the legislature that would lead to that. Senator Limmer, do these bills apply? Is it moving it up from repeat offenders to first offenders? Is that the part of the intent here, is to remove the discretion to treat first offenders differently than repeat offenders?
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I believe this is designed, I think it's focused on even first offenders.
Maybe I'll ask Mr. Chair.
Senator Latz.
Maybe I'll ask Mr. Backus for a clarification there.
Mr. Backus, would you shed some light?
Mr. Chair, members, the 609.11 sentences apply both to repeat and essentially first-timers, but the crux of both Senator Limmer and Senator Gazelka's bill is to address those offenders for which a waiver is authorized under statute. And a waiver isn't authorized if the person commits one of the designated offenses and has a prior conviction for one of those offenses used with a dangerous weapon or a firearm.
Thank you, Mr. Backus.
If I may clarify, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Backus, the waiver is not authorized under current statute, what does the bill itself actually do with regard to that? I'm trying to understand, if we don't pass this bill, first-time offenders could potentially be subject to that waiver of the mandatory minimums, but if we do pass this bill, that waiver will not be available for first-time offenders as well?
Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Letts, I believe that's correct. Under current law, a prosecutor can make a motion or the court can make its own motion. And if the court finds, based on substantial and compelling reasons, that not to impose the mandatory minimum, the court can do that. So the court can do that, except there's a specific statutory, there's a statutory authorization for them to do that. And then there's a statutory prohibition for them to do that in the case of what is essentially a repeat offense. It's a little more complicated than that, how it's described. But if you look at subdivision 8 of 609.11, it lays it all out.
So, Mr. Chairman, it sounds like it's pretty tough or not possible for prosecutors or judges to sentence without regard to the mandatory minimums for repeat offenders. And it sounds like these bills would make first-time offenders subject to the mandatory minimums as well. So I'm a little bit concerned. I'm a lot concerned about removing the concept of prosecutorial discretion in how to handle cases and judicial discretion in how to handle cases. We went over this last time we were in front of the committee on similar provisions, but there's no way that we in the legislature can produce a one-size-fits-all statute that's going to be fair to every person that comes into the criminal justice system. That's why we have prosecutors, and that's why we have judges, and that's why the whole concept of prosecutorial discretion and judicial discretion exists, even to the point where there may be some questions about constitutional separation of powers as to how far we can go in the legislature with regard to some of this. But I'm reading, let's see here, Senate File 2673 on the second page, the language that struck through. So if we read the bottom of page 1, paragraph C, the court would not be allowed to, on its own motion, the prosecutor's motion. Well, this language is being struck through. So why is paragraph C being deleted, I guess, in 2673? That's a prohibition on using the mandatory on the waiver. Something about the way this is drafted, I'm not quite understanding.
Set for the author for,
I guess,
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair, members, the stricken paragraph C beginning on line 1.21, the reason that is stricken is because it relates to the mandatory minimums under subdivision 5. Subdivision 5 is the firearm mandatory minimums. So in Senator Limmer's bill, since a court couldn't sentence without regard to the mandatory minimum for a firearms offense, that language would also no longer be necessary because the court wouldn't have the authority to sentence without regard to that.
So, Mr. Backus.
Senator Letts.
Does that mean that some of the stricken language here on page 2, if a person, in a crime in which a firearm is used, and there's an accomplice who is in possession of the firearm, which is language that's being struck through on 2.1, does that mean that defendant who is charged would not be able to be sentenced without regard to mandatory minimums because an accomplice possessed a firearm?
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Letts, that's correct.
So I'm just trying to envision fact circumstances that might work for this, Mr. Chairman. So if two people drive up in a car, one person gets out of the car, steals a purse from someone on the street, and their accomplice who is in the car is within reach of a gun which is in the glove compartment. Glove compartment's closed, gun is never taken out of it, never shown to the victim, not used in any way in the actual commission of the crime. But within the language of the statute here, an accomplice within immediate reach of the firearm, then the defendant who physically took the purse from the victim would be absolutely subject to the mandatory minimum here. Even if the defendant didn't know that the accomplice had a firearm in the glove compartment. Mr. Backus, am I understanding, am I applying that hypothetical correctly here?
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and members, I mean, big picture, yes. I mean, certainly if a person possesses a firearm or the accomplice possesses a firearm, then the mandatory minimum under current law would kick in. You know, as to the specifics of your scenario where the firearm is in the glove compartment, you know, again, that would have to be considered possession. But if the court or if that was determined to be possession, then the person would be subject to the mandatory minimum.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Backus, I'll note that on line 2.1, the language includes possession or within immediate reach. So presumably a person in the right front passenger seat is within immediate reach of a gun that's in the glove compartment that's right in front of them. And there's no intent element to this in the statute. So even if a person doesn't know their accomplice has a firearm, the accomplice who's sort of participating by helping out, maybe they're the ones that drove the vehicle, and the gun's in the armrest, something, but the passenger doesn't know about it, the passenger jumps out, takes a purse, gets back in the car, accomplice drives away. Passenger has no idea there's even a gun in the car. No element, no intent element here, but that passenger then, when charged with the crime, would be treated as if he knew there was a gun in the car and would be facing a mandatory minimum sentence with no options for a prosecutor or a judge to account for the fact that they had no idea there was a gun in the possession of or within reach of the driver of the vehicle. That seems to me a scenario which would be patently unfair. Maybe a different situation if they take a gun out and they brandish it, and the victim legitimately thinks, all that, you know, if I don't give the purse up, I'm going to get shot. You know, that to me is kind of a different scenario than a purse snatching when someone who's in the car driving it has a gun, but the purse snatcher doesn't know. What would the actual mandatory minimum sentence be under that scenario, Mr. Backus?
I'm sorry, Senator Letts. I was thinking about something as you were talking. Just to point one thing out, the paragraph C language that you're referring to is a bit of a subset of the main language. If you look at the main language on you have to kind of go back to the subdivision 5, which isn't reproduced in the bill. That refers to possessing or using a firearm. That doesn't have the added language you mentioned about being within immediate reach. The being within immediate reach is specific to the paragraph C. So it only applies to those mandatory minimums. And that's for... if you give me a second, I think that's for first and second degree controlled substance sales crimes. So just to make that clear, I don't know if I made that clear or more confusing. Sorry.
Well, Mr. Chairman, so either way,
Senator Lantz.
Let's change the hypothetical. We could either assume it's in the possession of the driver, if it's in the armrest that the driver's right arm can rest on, or we could assume, let's say the gun's in their waistband, but the passenger has no idea it's there. You end up with the same, what I think would be unfair result. Or at least you remove the discretion of the judge and the prosecutor to consider those facts in determining what's the appropriate sentence. But I guess I come back to the other question. What is the mandatory minimum sentence? That's 5 years, isn't it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lantz, for the so-called first-time offense, it's a 3-year mandatory minimum. If it's considered the repeat, then it's a 5-year for a firearm for possession or use.
Okay. But for the first-timers, the ones I'm, which this bill is addressing, right? It's not really addressing the repeat offenders. It's the first-time offenders. 3 years under those circumstances. So I have a question for Senator Limmer, if I may.
Senator Limmer? Yes.
Senator Limmer, you gave us a lot of statistics on downward departures and so on. But do your statistics include what percentage of those who were not sentenced to prison were sentenced instead to up to a year in the county workhouse?
I do not, Mr. Chair. I don't have that figure in my computations.
So,
Senator Lantz.
Mr. Chairman, it's quite possible that some of that 40% that received a downward departure didn't go to prison. I would hazard a guess, pretty substantial portion, maybe all of them, received some jail time, which could be up to a year in the local workhouse. I don't think it's fair to suggest that because they were not sentenced to prison, they had no consequences, were not removed from the streets.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
Are you done? Sorry to interrupt you.
No, I'd like to hear what Senator Limmer has to say.
Mr. Chairman, I think these two bills are designed to stem the tide of criminals using a gun in the commission of a crime. I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference if you're a victim, whether or not that's a first-time offender or if it's a repeat offender. The goal is to use these pieces of legislation in order to stem that tide. There's tremendous cost to crime in Minneapolis and St. Paul right now. We're going to pay for it one way or the other. We're going to pay for it through victims and the loss they have or the fear that they will have and carry for the rest of their lives, or it'll be translated into a prison term. It's unfortunate that we're at this point, but quite honestly, if we don't do anything, I'm afraid that we're still going to continue this rise in crime and that it'll continue as kind of a pattern of whether it's entertainment by certain people or whether it's a criminal enterprise that wants to dominate a community. Whatever it is, there's a cost to it. This is a path that we use. Those four elements of why we have incarceration is to hopefully stop the criminal element, stop that crime. And there's four different reasons, as I mentioned. But quite honestly, if we do nothing, I'm very well convinced that we will continue down this path and more of our innocent citizens will be victimized.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Senator Lantz.
First of all, I don't think it's fair to say that it might be for entertainment purposes. I think that's a bit beyond the pale to suggest people are out there killing other people for entertainment purposes.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
We have had experiences where gang members for initiation will impose a requirement of a new member to go attack someone or shoot someone.
I'm aware of that, Mr. Chairman. I don't.
Perhaps maybe entertainment was not the proper term, but to tell you the truth, I think there are some in the criminal element that do things for fun, and I think I could find examples of that.
All right,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Lantz, let's get back to the bill at hand here. I think we're getting a little bit of field.
I'd like
thank
to,
you,
Mr. Chairman. Senator Limmer, do you have any empirical data to back up the suggestion that locking more people up for a longer period of time is going to prevent the kind of crime that you're concerned about?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
I think the data in reverse kind of speaks of the other fact. If we have judges that are not imposing proper sentences, we're beginning to experience a rise in crime, a specific crime of violence using a firearm.
Mr. Chairman, that really wasn't my question. Senator Limmer, does that mean you don't have any data to suggest that this proposed remedy would solve the problem?
Well, Mr. Chairman, now we're getting into kind of a philosophical debate on what stops crime. What is the cause of crime? What works and what doesn't? I think over time, I think my studies have been that there's different times during different eras that certain punishments do correct crime, others do not. They fail. Until a person really has a heart change, they really don't. They will continue down that path. Maybe not to the extreme of using firearms in the commission of a crime. I would tend to think that there may not be any reference over many years of what actually works to prevent crime. But I do know that if those 40% of the people that committed crimes and did not get a serious penalty, a mandatory minimum, it lends to the point of creating repeat offenders. We do know there are repeat offenders. I'm suggesting, and I think the public would want us to consider this, to consider the deterrent factor of a serious penalty for using a crime against an innocent citizen.
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's an unfair question to ask for some empirical data that the proposal would have the effect that's desired. We will all agree here unanimously that we want to stop violent crime from occurring. I think it's incumbent upon us to delve into what some of the causes of crime are before necessarily backing a particular proposed solution. This particular proposed solution is very expensive. We're being asked, or will be asked, potentially, to authorize what will end up being $23 million expenditure in the next biennium. Without any empirical data to back up the claim that this will actually reduce violent crime. That's a lot of money. I could sit here and we could argue for a long time about whether or not the cause of violent crime has as much to do with disinvestment in jobs and education and community and after-school programs and youth intervention in the very neighborhoods where this crime has been rising, economic distress in those very neighborhoods where crime has been rising, police misconduct in the very neighborhoods where crime has been rising. There's been a tremendous amount of resistance from the majority in the Senate to passing legislation that would address much of the police misconduct that's been proposed over the last several years since George Floyd was murdered by police in Minneapolis. There's been a pandemic in the last several years, and I will notice not just Minnesota where you've seen a rise in violent crime, it's around the country because the pandemic has been all over the country. Where's the proposal, where's the willingness to spend this kind of money to address those issues? Sometimes it's like pulling teeth to get enough money just to fund a portion of the demand for the youth intervention program out of this committee. Where's the willingness to spend our taxpayer money on those things? But instead, there seems to be a strong willingness among some to spend that money to lock people up after the fact. We could do a lot more good, I think, trying to prevent the crime in the first place. And, you know, while it's certainly easy to say that, you know, if you prevent the first timer from being on the street, they're not going to commit another crime on the street. That doesn't necessarily mean that the first timer is going to be committing another crime on the street. Maybe if we funded probation enough to make sure that there was enough oversight for people on the street who are teaching some of the first timers, we'd have less crime in our communities. Maybe if we did a better job with juvenile response and support, we'd have fewer of the teenagers out there committing crimes or carrying firearms because they're afraid of others that might commit crimes against them, and sometimes they get caught up in something as well. I mean, there are a lot of places that could use a lot more investment, I think, than warehousing first-timers for at least 3 years with a cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all approach to sentencing. I can guarantee you if any one of us had kids that got caught up in a system and we thought that there was some reason why some leniency might apply to our particular child's circumstance, we'd be begging the court for some leniency. And then there's some who should not get that kind of leniency, absolutely. And that's why you've got 60%+ are going away for the mandatory minimums without any downward departures. But you can talk about taking a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old and putting them away for a minimum of 3 years without any understanding of whether they're going away because it's an accomplice that was in possession of a firearm, even if they didn't use a firearm in the actual commission of the offense. An accomplice that they didn't even know had a firearm and a kid's going away for 3 years. That seems really, really unfair. It seems like a real big waste of time and taxpayer money. And frankly, sending them to prison might be the worst thing you could do because they go to prison and they're gonna spend their time with hardened criminals who are gonna become their cohort group and their network of connections, and who's going to teach them in prison how to be better criminals, perhaps. And then when they get released, they're going to be a whole lot harder to control than if you kept them out, gave them the services to maybe get them off of the path that they were on. So this doesn't work for everyone. There are lots of people who commit crimes that should go away to prison. But a one-size-fits-all approach like this, without any empirical data to suggest it's even going to help, it's not worth $22 million to me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Latz pointed out the cost, $25 million. I'd like you to think of the people back home. $25 million, we have 5 million, roughly a little over 5 million people in the state of Minnesota. Roughly that equates to $4 to $5 per person to make sure that people who commit crimes with a gun against an innocent citizen will be locked up based on their conviction. I think if I went around and took a poll, I think that come out to about 100% of voters supporting that type of conviction. Quite honestly, I know we're having a great discussion about defendants and those who are convicted, but I want to keep the focus on another subject, and that's victims. I can't go anywhere without people talking about crime and law enforcement, and especially the crime involving that close intimacy of a carjacking or someone facing a gun in a dark parking lot. Quite honestly, I'm fearfully concerned that our judges are not doing the right thing. 40% of those cases are not resulting in a conviction of putting that person away for using and brandishing a gun to commit a crime. We also have other crimes as well. I don't know if our current list of sanctions is really working. And I don't know how anyone can say they are when you have this type of an increase in violent crime. Not every proposal in our sentencing toolbox is a cure-all for everything. This one won't be either. But at least it's another approach, especially with those who might be considered the worst of the worst with a gun to victimize someone. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll be open for further questions.
Thank you. I do have a couple more on the list here. It's been patiently waiting. Senator Kiffmeyer. And Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I was glad to see you, Senator Limmer, and Senator Gazalka together presenting these bills. I know that Senator Gazalka, and you have talked about these before, he's been interested before, but as a majority leader, that was a very infrequent ability to author bills that you may be interested in due to the role of majority leader. So it's good to see him here today having that opportunity and to work on some of these bills that he's had an interest in before and discuss. But I would say, so Senator Limmer, the big thing here is we're talking about people on a first-time offense in this category having to do with great bodily harm. So this isn't just bumping someone. These are extremely violent, serious offenses and great bodily harm. And as we've kind of gone off on some of these other things, I feel like I just need to get back to understanding again great bodily harm and what kind of offenses these are that we're talking about here that would be required to remove a criminal. This is after all appropriate rights and opportunities, but once they have been convicted, we're talking about sentencing here for great bodily harm. So could you clarify for me again the level of offense in regards to the bill that you have here?
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, why don't we pass that on to Mr. Backus?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Backus, would you be able to field that one?
Mr. Chair, members, just to clarify, the law doesn't require great bodily harm as a trigger for the sentencing. I think the great bodily harm reference may have come from the definition of the dangerous weapon. But in order to be sentenced under 609.11, currently or under the bill, there's no requirement that there be any kind of actual injury inflicted on the victim.
Sorry, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I'm hearing you say then in regards to this, though, is that there is a crime of a level that has the potential to do that. I mean, we're not talking about, we're talking about very serious crimes that would have a mandatory sentence. So I appreciate that clarity because, Mr. Backus, when I heard you say that before, that's when I was wondering about that impact. I think the big thing here is that we recognize that in that period of time at which they are having a requirement, they're not on the street hurting other people. I did a little bit of research in regards to some of these situations, and Arizona State University has a center for problem-oriented policing. And so they had some issues here. In particular, it was incapacitation, deterrence, and how important that was, because you have to remember that in these situations for these victims, having the criminals back after they've been adjudicated and convicted, having them back on the street or not even being prosecuted, the general population finds that very concerning and makes them fearful and that they are going to be vulnerable to repeat offenders. And matter of fact, in regards to that, in this repeat offending as well, I was interesting that, again, a statistic from the same study, 5 to 6% of the population is found to commit 50 to 60% of all recorded crime. And the most effective thing is to have consequences earlier to get them off the street, get them away from vulnerable people. And I know that our prisons here in Minnesota have programs and other things for them, but we recognize that. But nonetheless, our biggest responsibility is to protect the public. Mothers, fathers, children, other kids, they're looking to us to put laws in place that protect them. And so I think it's important to realize that kind of a context. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. And we do still have one more bill up after this, so we're getting close to our time. If we can make our points, and we'll move forward to that. So, Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot to unpack in the debate so far, and in the search and quest for data, while it's good, members, it should also not replace just basic common sense. If someone commits a crime and is, if someone commits a violent crime under this statute and is sent away for 3 years, it'll be three fewer years that person's available to commit future crimes than not. And a comment was made about how it's difficult to do downward departures on repeat offenders, but unfortunately, that's not always been the case. I mean, the reason why we're even here discussing this bill is because of just the unconscionable surge in violent crimes that is now on the minds and tongues of almost every Minnesotan. And the worst case that I pulled it up, I'm sure you all saw the news article last fall from the St. Paul shooting. The media even pointed out the criminal in that case should have been committed crimes that should have sent him to jail four times previously in just a couple of year period. Only happened once. That person, there's a very good argument to be made that had a downward departure not been made earlier, had he not been spun back out on the street, that shooting would not have occurred on that day. And that's the point that we are getting at here. This is just basic common sense, members. And if we're afraid, if people are watching at home, if young people are watching at home and there's a concern about, well, I might end up being an accomplice to a theft where there's a gun in the car that I don't know about and I'm going to get hit with a greater charge on this, let me tell to the kids back home watching, there's a 100% effective way to not find yourself in that situation. Don't steal cars. It's bad to go out and commit crimes. Don't even put yourself in a position where that might be an issue. This is just basic common sense. The status quo is not working. There are too many getting spun back out of the system that are getting little, if any, punishment or consequence for their violent actions and have gone out and committed more violent offenses. Minnesota Freedom Fund has bailed out a number of people that went back out and committed more violent offenses. Crime Watch groups are tracking these info and statistics and reporting it regularly. So, if the other branch, if the judicial system hasn't been doing their job under the status quo, then yes, it is time to come in with some stronger floors and some mandatory minimums and not allow them to keep spinning people back out on the streets to commit more crime. And that's why I support these bills. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Matthews. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Well, that's that's a pretty tough one to follow there. A lot of the points that I wanted to make, Senator Matthews has been very articulate about. But the minimum mandatory right now has been overlooked, and up to 40% of the time. So when you think things aren't working, there's a reason why, and that's probably one of the biggest reasons why. So when we talk about cleaning up a mess, and I think one of the senators said that county attorneys are cleaning up the legislature's mess. Quite frankly, it's the other way around. And I think Senator Limmer alluded to this as well. Obviously, they're taking it upon themselves to release these potentially dangerous individuals back into the system, kind of overlooking the legislature. It's time, and I'm glad you, Senator Limmer and Senator Gazelka, are bringing these bills forward. The public, where I live, is talking the same. That's all they talk about. When are you going to do something about this crime? When we're second and third in the nation for lowest incarceration rates, anybody that you talk on the street is going to tell you that's not working. Anybody with any kind of common sense. So if you need statistics, you know, for is this going to work or isn't it, let's get a few of those folks off the street. let's do that. Let's get them off the street. And if they continue, and if their compadres, whether it be gangs or whatever, continue to do this and not understand what's going on, or if they're not paying attention to us passing laws, then they ought to be out there doing some other things other than using dangerous weapons. Now, Senator Latz talked about some hypotheticals, which he's very good at, and I appreciate that. Bowling ball, I guess, was talked about, or an umbrella could be a dangerous weapon. Frankly, yes, if that bowling ball is taken out of the case and it's used to bludgeon somebody's head to death, you've now changed that into from a recreation piece of equipment to a dangerous weapon, no different than an umbrella. I know people that are strong enough to kill somebody with an umbrella if they set out to do it, whether they impale them or whether they hit them over the head hard enough to kill them. A stick? Yeah, a good-sized oak stick. I'm sure it's been used many times. In fact, I think it wasn't that many years ago. We looked at statistics in Minnesota where bludgeoning was one of the bigger ways of, by means of killing people. And that was with sticks, clubs, hammers. I was involved in a hammer murder one time where this poor young girl was beaten to death with a hammer. So obviously you're not going to argue with a hammer or something like that, but it's when you throw those kind of hypotheticals out there, yeah, you can be charged with that. Then, of course, we talk about police misconduct when we don't have anything else to talk about. I guess we could, you know, we talk about the cost. We talk about the incarceration rate's going to cost $23 million or something. Something to that effect. I'm not sure exactly what it was, $21 million. I remember a case not too far from here where actually the family was paid $23 million for a cop shooting where the cop was exonerated. And I've got people still talking about that going, how does that happen? How does that work? Now, that doesn't have anything to do with this case, but if you want to bring up police misconduct all the time, you should probably be listening to some of that stuff too. So financially, you know, I came into the session saying I wasn't going to deal with Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'm not, you know, I'm a rural legislator. I'm not going to do this. I don't have to do this. Well, I do. I do, because we're all Minnesotans. Senator Latz, you pointed that out very eloquently before. So does John, and another committee, John Marty. But I'd have a lot of people that used to send their kids to the cities for college, and they're saying there's no way. There's just no way are we going to allow that. We're not going to send them down here. I'm embarrassed to even hear that. I really am. And it behooves us all to take a tougher look at this crime. And it's time that we're passing some of these bills like this and say we're not going to tolerate this garbage anymore. And that's exactly what it is. It's poison to our system, and yes, they're going to have to go to jail and they're going to have to spend some time. Is this going to make them bigger criminals? I don't know. I guess they got that choice as well. If they come out again and commit another crime, they should be dealt with 10 times as harshly. And that's something that we can do in the legislature as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senators, for bringing those bills forward.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to clarify, if we don't have stakeholders like the county attorneys here, we could be doing things that would then later cause us consternation or problems. That was my comments. And I think my concern is we have no testifiers here on the actual implementation of how these changes, and I'm not saying I disagree with them at all. I'm just saying it would be nice to have the practitioners here to kind of give comment on it. So that was my context.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
If I could just, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Just real quick follow up on that. And I understand that. I get that. But I also like to hear the County Attorneys Association defend the three county attorneys that I know of that have thrown their responsibility towards the Attorney General when it comes to homicides in the metro area. So there's some questions to be asked of the county attorneys, and I can hardly wait until they do show up at this committee.
Thank you, Senator Ingebretson. Any further comments with that? Thank you, Senator Limmer. Appreciate the testimony and comments today. We'll be laying those bills over, and we will move on then to Senate File 2850, Senator Jasinski. Senator Jasinski, thank you for joining us today. We will get right into your bill. It looks like we've got a good 10 minutes left here. So,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to be here on Senate File number 2850. But before I go into some talking points, I want to bring it down to a level. You all know I was involved in Senator Eric Mattson and the Mattson bill. So while you're sitting listening to my talking points, I want you to think about Eric Mattson, his wife Megan, his two children. I know Senator Bigham met them and had a real impact based on what happened to Senator Eric Mattson. So while I'm going through my talking points, I ask, please keep the family of Eric Mattson in your mind when I'm going through my talking points. Under current law, the Department of Corrections inmate serving prison time for a felony is eligible to earn good time off if the offender behaves well and follows prison rules. The amount of time an offender may earn is up to one-third of the offender's executed sentence. My bill increases that period from an offender must spend in prison for three-quarters of the executed prison term, with only one-fourth of the eligible for early release and community supervision. Although some states have a way for inmates to earn credit for good time behavior, the range across the board is across the board throughout all 50 states based on recent NCSL data. It depends on the type of crime in some instances, but many state laws earning good time seem to be between one-third and nothing at all. The federal government recently promulgated rules under the 2018 First Step Act that prisoner may earn up to 54 days per year of a sentence for good behavior. That's 15%. Here in Minnesota, we historically have had one of the lowest incarceration rates in the country, meaning we do not send that many people to prison. Only the worst of the worst and habitual offenders will end up serving time. The current administration is apparently no longer revoking for technical violations, which is another way of saying we do not really care about offenders meeting expectations or being able to abide by the rules. Between January of 2020 to July of 2021, from January of 2020 to July of 2021, the number of inmates incarcerated dropped by approximately 2,000 inmates, which represents over 20% of the entire population in Minnesota. We are now starting to bounce back from the pandemic and the criminal case backlog at the courts, but the trends towards lessening any consequences for crimes is going the wrong way. Judges are also sentencing a lot of downward departures, which we discussed in the earlier bill, which includes both one, dispositional departures, whether someone goes to prison or serves probation, and two, duration departures, how long the person is sentenced. Both of these trends seem to indicate that we do not care about punishments that fit the crime. And in my mind, nothing could be farther from the truth. The legislature is now being forced to step in to ensure that those individuals who should be going to prison are doing so for a sufficient length of time. My bill is one way to get that goal of having the worst or most repeat criminals actually serve their time in prison and the punishment fits the crime. Again, as we've heard in Minnesota court cases, there are four reasons of incarceration. First, retribution, serving time away for a convicted person to pay the harm inflicted on the victim, called consequences. Number two, Incapacitation, physical removal of the convicted person from society to prevent them from committing future crimes. Again, keep in mind Eric Mattson. Deterrence, my favorite. Prevention of future crime, both as an example to others and the idea that those who have committed crimes will be discouraged from committing further crimes after incarceration. Number four, rehabilitation to become a law-abiding citizen. I believe that all four of these purposes can be better served by this bill, all of which can boost Minnesota's safety. Again, Eric Mattson's perpetrator was out on parole. He should not have been on the streets, and he altered the life of not only Eric, his wife, and his two children forever. He was out on the street on parole. Senate File 2850 addresses these issues, and with that, I stand for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak for or against this bill? I do not see any. We'll open it up for committee discussion or questions. Senator Lance.
Mr. Chairman, what's the fiscal note for this bill?
Mr. Turner, do you have that handy?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, according to the sentencing guidelines, first year, 2023, this bill would result in 42 new beds at a cost of $401,000. Second year, 2024, would be 130 beds at $1,503,000. Third year, 261 beds, that's fiscal year 25. That would be $3,341,000. And then it goes on, it maxes out in 2033 at approximately $14 million a year in additional correctional costs.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir, Lance.
Seems that all the GOP senators got the same memo here on with talking points for getting tough on crime, because we've now heard, I think, repeated several times today and certainly in past hearings about the four reasons for our criminal justice system, which is sort of first-year law school, criminal law course information. But I'll ask Senator Jasinski the same question I've asked before, is whether or not there's any empirical data to support the position that, this proposal would have a substantial reduction in criminal activity.
Senator Latz, Republican members might be hearing the same theme from constituents as well. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Latz. Again, I'll go back to Senator Limmers. You know, it's a discussion of what we want to do in the state and how we want to address crime, and I think everything we can do to keep people safe in the streets is what I hear in my Senate district as well. I actually was in the Navy and college all over the United States, and I keep getting messages from my either Navy shipmates or college people say, what is going on in Minnesota? What's up with the crime there? So it's a philosophical discussion, as Senator Limmer pointed out, but I believe citizens want people put behind bars. Again, I'd go back to Megan Mattson, and she was, crying, saying, why did my husband, this person should not be on the streets? So I don't have any data as you're asking for, but I think everybody in my district want to see people deterring from creating or committing crimes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Jasinski, I know we saw last year or heard about the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, the governor and Commissioner Snell were proposing. And, a couple of takeaways from that was that, number one, they were trying to reduce the sentence served to 50%, which is a unique proposal because they said it did two things. Number one, it saved $10 million a year for our state. And then number two, it gave hope to the inmates, which I don't think is very quantifiable in and of itself. But it was two of the reasonings, rationales that were given for that. Now, I think as a state, our citizens expect us to do the bare bones of government, right? You know, it's public safety, it's roads and bridges, it's those sorts of things. And here we are arguing with the governor, saying, hey, let's keep our cities and our streets safe by having criminals do what we expect them to do and spend some time behind bars. And, you know, we really are having this debate now with a governor and a commissioner who say, you know, we should really just be as lenient as we can on these to give them some hope and to save $10 million. I know my constituents feel that that's money well spent. We appreciate the proposal that you're bringing forward today. I think it's well worth looking at as a way to reduce the crime and increase the punishment and the number of other things that you had listed there. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Senator Kickmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the biggest thing in realizing here is in regards to Officer Mattson and his family, and not just him, but so many others who have been in these situations that they'd be alive today, they wouldn't be harmed today, if it wouldn't have been that the perpetrator is back out on the street again, and they weren't protected from that harm to a known risk and a known danger. I think it's really important to remember, it's about those who are, we are here for their safety. And if the courts and the prosecutors are having trouble with this under current law, then listening to our constituents, so many across the state of Minnesota, and saying, then we need to look at legislation to help rectify the issue. It's very straightforward. Thank you, Senator Jasinski.
Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, comment was made that some of these things are basic first-year law school stuff, which makes it even more incredulous why experienced attorneys in prosecutorial roles are doing these actions that boggle the mind, that go against any form of and semblance of common sense, that non-lawyers, everyday citizens on the street can see that the system as it's being practiced and enacted today doesn't work. And it also makes me wonder if the soft on crime talking points are getting passed around, because we're dealing with it in Minneapolis, they're dealing with it in New York, they're dealing it in Los Angeles, all at the same time. Members, this is putting a stake in the ground of going, the status quo is not working. We cannot go soft on crime. And this is one option being set forward to continue to send a strong message on that. So thank you, Senator Jasinski, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lance.
Mr. Chairman, what we have not heard, you know, sometimes we hear the chairman and others come here and say, this is evidence-based decision-making. Today we have zero evidence-based decision-making, no empirical data to suggest what's proposed. The alternative that we're told here is just common sense. So we are all supposed to use common sense to make these decisions. And there's obviously a value to that. We all have our lived experiences and our judgments based on what we know and our and the worlds that we come from and the constituents that we hear from. But I, for one, would like to rely a little more on data than just taking a guess. I've already gone through with the other bills some of the gaps in the analysis here. I think we need a more robust analysis before we decide whether to support something like this. But I do want to raise one particular point, because it was brought up about the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, and as its main goal being saving $10 million. Well, that's not only a gross oversimplification, it's just an inaccurate statement of what that act does. That act is proposed to have four main components. One is an individualized rehabilitation plan, so that when people come into prison, there is an individualized plan to help them rehabilitate while they are there. It creates an incentive for earned release time. So rather than just complying with the rules and getting a benefit from it, it includes active participation in things like drug treatment programs and other behavioral components, substance abuse treatment, mental health counseling, vocational skills training, education. They get an incentive for participating in those things that will make them less likely to recidivate when they get released. That's how they earn their reduced prison time. Earn supervision abatement. So once released, they can again earn reduced probation time if they are doing well by meeting concrete, personalized goals such as maintaining employment, chemical health aftercare programming, mental health follow-up counseling, positive family and community reintegration. These are all very specific and concrete things that would create incentives for people to behave better, with the understanding that incentives, and you ask any behavioral person about this, incentives are far more powerful than punishment for changing a behavior. And then finally, it's not just a $10 million back to the general fund. It was proposed to be split four ways. One quarter of that goes back into the general fund, but the other three quarters goes equally into victim support services, which is also chronically underfunded in this state. Strategic investments in crime prevention and intervention initiatives, and reinvestment in community-based correctional programs. That's our probation system, folks. That's what the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act was intended to do. And I will also add, it was supported by the philosophically on the far right as well as on the left. The Right on Crime organizations across the country also support that approach. Maybe we should have a more comprehensive approach here to solving crime and not just let's get tough, throw them in the jail, throw away the key, lock them up, because of course they're not on the streets if they're locked up in jail. But it's far more complex than that simple proposed solution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Senator Jasinski.
Great.
Didn't have the mic on. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Great discussion. Thank you. And again, talking about all those things, and again, you know, one of my talking points was other states from one-third to nothing for good behavior, and we're on the far end of that spectrum. So things are not working in Minnesota, so I believe changing this somewhat, not going to nothing, but altering from the one-third makes sense. And again, going to the victims, it's about the victims, and listening to the story and watching what's happened in the Eric Mattson family, I think we owe it to try and make our citizens more safe, and I think this bill will do that. So thank you again for hearing the bill, and thank you for the great discussion.
Any further discussion regarding Senator Jasinski's bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lowndes.
Since Senator Jasinski's bringing up other states, the actual data, if we would bother to look at it, shows that in Minnesota in 2020, there were 278 violent crimes for every 100,000 people, where the nationwide average is 399. So it seems to me Minnesota's doing something right, not something wrong, because our average violent crime rate is substantially lower than the national average. And that's with our current system of being heavily reliant on a probationary process and less on incarceration. So we are, in fact, the national model for the way we handle things. And the fact that Minnesota, along with all sorts of other states around the country, are seeing increased crime rates, it's not because of our lack of punishment. It's because of other things going on in the community that affect crime rates. And until we address those other things going on in the community, we're never going to get a handle on this.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, real quickly.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lass.
Just wanted to remind our members that we're a little off on our time. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I just wanted to know, and we can do this offline, Senator Lass, but if those statistics include the reduction and the bargaining that goes on in the court system from more serious crimes to lesser crimes, if that's included in our crime rate, I don't think there's any statistics that shows that, but the public needs to know that that goes on all the time, and
And that's a whole day, another discussion, reducing sentences just to get them cleared and get them off the table. Happens a lot.
Well, for the public benefit, this is why we have discussions and why we lay over bills to continue the discussion. These are good ideas to consider and nevertheless, good ideas to discuss. There's no further business before this committee. We stand adjourned. Thank you all.